Hi, everyone. Welcome to Teaching Matters. This podcast is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. I'm your host, Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University. Reading is one of the most fundamental skills. I see it in my college students' classrooms, but of course, if you teach K-12 or even pre-K-12, you know the importance of reading for developmental skill development among students in really any subject that they're learning. So we're going to be doing a two-part series on the science of reading and how that can get applied and be helpful inside of classroom situations. My guest for this episode is Joe Burns. He has taught a variety of early childhood age levels and was also an intervention specialist. He is currently a regional product manager for Capstone, an educational technology and publishing company that emphasizes equitable access to education. That name sounds familiar. We previously had Randy Ikinamu, who is also from Capstone. She was a guest in October of last year. Joe has also written several articles examining the science of reading, including a December 23 article in eSchool News. Joe, thank you for being on Teaching Matters today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm super excited.
Yeah. So I want to start by delving a little bit more into your background as a classroom teacher first. We were actually talking about the health implications of that before we started recording, but if you could give us a little bit more of a background of sort of the age levels that you taught, and I think particularly when you're talking about that, I'm sure that you made observations when you were in the classroom about just how important reading skills were for the development of your students. Can you kind of comment on that as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've been in and around education, you know, kind of forever, my whole life. I think with hindsight, I'd love to go back to 16-year-old me and say, hey, it's obvious this is what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life. So don't fight it. You know, dating back even to like my community service project in eighth grade, I remember was me getting shuttled off to the elementary school to do tutoring. My work study in high school was going to the elementary school to fill in for whatever they needed. I kind of went from there. My undergrad was communication disorders, which was the combination of audiology and speech language pathology. And while not exactly education, you know, they're really looking at expressive and receptive speech. They're looking at language acquisition, whether it's listening, speaking, hearing, reading, or writing. And kind of fundamentally, that's what reading instruction is, especially at the elementary level. Mm-hmm. So after I finished my undergrad at UConn, you know, big UConn plug right now, Selection Sunday, number one overall seed. Let's go for that repeat. It's our only professional sports team in Connecticut. So,
well, and not to get too far away from the topic, but that's one of a few schools that have both men and women's in the big dance, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we really, that is our team. But yeah, so super pumped about that. And then kind of immediately afterwards, you know, when I was at that point where I could either go into audiology for what would have been a bajillion years because you have to get your doctorate and whatnot to be able to practice that, or a master's for speech pathology, kind of took a U-turn and went back to what was always obvious to everyone else and got my master's in elementary education. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have that degree, K-6 curriculum and instruction, and that's also what my certification was, and was fortunate enough that right after I finished my master's in 2012, got a job right away in a small district in Connecticut, on the shore, just like an amazing and beautiful community, and started off as a kindergarten teacher, which was the last thing I thought I was going to do. I remember when I was applying to schools and to districts, my idea was essentially, I will teach anything except kindergarten. And this was a district that I really, really liked. They had a lot of openings that year, and they were also moving to, for the first time ever, a full day K program. Mm. And I interviewed and they offered me a K position because they wanted someone, I guess, to help kind of pioneer and create that program moving forward. And they really liked my background in speech language pathology because a lot of the fundamentals of that are the fundamentals of reading when it comes to kindergarten.
Yeah.
Right. That's where you learn about phonological awareness and phonemic awareness and all of these different listening skills that precede any actual reading, right? Because in order for us to actually be able to read, we need to be able to listen first. You can't teach a kid what sound a B makes if they can't differentiate between all of the different sounds that letters.
Yeah.
Make,
interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they really loved that background, and that was kind of where I ended up getting my start. I very quickly shifted to third and fourth grade. Eventually our school actually ended up departmentalizing, which is super strange at the elementary level, but it was a really great take from our principal, someone that I really admired, Alicia Daw. You know, we had a really challenging demographic, and our learners were all over the place, which I know is true for absolutely everybody. And it was really difficult as a third or a fourth grade teacher to be preparing for a third grader who's reading on level, a third grader who's reading at a first grade level, a third grader who's reading at a fifth grade level, and then having to do the same thing in math as well. And looking at it, you know, we realized, hey, we're prepping, you know, 9 to 10 essentially different lessons for every day. So we departmentalized, which was really amazing because then you got to specialize in kind of one area. And I think that was an amazing decision that she made there. And it really, me personally, it helped a lot because you could focus on just making sure you were prepared for what your specific students needed on a much smaller band. So you could really go a significant amount deeper. And then, now recently, and I'll circle back to that because math is what I settled into for a little while. And now I spend a lot of time in reading instruction. But after that, I ended up at Capstone Publishing, which really was, that was me kind of sitting down one day. I think at the time I was 34. So it was, you know, about 3 years ago, and realizing I've been in school since kindergarten, right? And like, really, if you think about it, since pre-K, I'd been in school for 30 years, either as a student or professionally. It's essentially the only thing I knew in my entire life was being in school. So because I was in a position where I loved my job, I loved the community that I was in, I felt safe enough to kind of look outside, and I really wanted to be able to maybe affect some change outside of just my bubble. As much as I loved like the small school that I was in and the small community, I thought it would be great if I could kind of take my passion and be able to help people outside of just the shoreline of Connecticut. So
right.
I started looking, and I was very, very prejudiced about where I was looking because I was in a great spot. And I wanted to find, you know, a company or something education related that shared a lot of the same values that I had. And I started by looking at companies that had a product that I liked to use. I had used Pebble Go a little bit in my classroom and I loved it. And that was how I actually knew about Capstone. And then when I dug into their website and I saw, you know, their core values being like, we succeed by making learning fun. It was kind of always the student was considered first. It wasn't a learning objective that was considered first. It wasn't raising some sort of test score that was considered first. It was like, hey, we just want kids to enjoy this stuff. Everything else can come after, but we really are here to make sure that kids genuinely have fun reading or genuinely have fun learning. And that's something that was really, really important to me. And the rest was kind of history. I joined Capstone as a content strategist. And then after a little over a year, I transitioned to my current role, which is, you know, as a regional product marketing manager. And really what I'm doing here is I'm just a step closer to the educator, which is much more my speed, right? Educators are my people. It's a lot easier for me to talk with them. So it was a very welcome change for me. And that's kind of how I ended up here.
Very good. So I want to turn and talk about some of the points that you raised in the eSchool News article that I read. One of the points that you make that I've noticed even in the state of Ohio is that more and more states are enacting legislation that promote the use of scientifically researched and documented reading strategies. As best as you can sort of read politics, which of course we're all experts on because of social media, as you think about that, why do you think that so many states are going to the step of enacting legislation or at least major initiatives about reading research-based strategies?
Yeah, I mean, I think like many large policies and just education in general, it's multifaceted, but the real elephant in the room is COVID really made us take a step back and look, right? The pandemic impacted our youngest learners more than anyone else, which I think you don't even really need research for that statement to hold true. I mean, who's more capable of grabbing a Chromebook or a device and logging into a Zoom, a 15-year-old or a 5-year-old? Like, it's obvious who's a little bit better equipped. I'm not saying that high schoolers had it easy, but there's a huge difference in terms of independence between those two. And kindergarten and first grade, you know, those poor kids, that's the year where you do letter sound correspondence,
right?
Where you learn A, apple, ah. That's where you learn about all of the different phonics skills. That's where you start to build those fundamentals of reading. And it's also where you start expanding your actual knowledge base. That's where, you know, school is where you're kind of challenged with a lot of new ideas and new topics. Mm-hmm. And these kids were not set up for success. And now a few years later, we're seeing kind of the results of that, right? We have these falling achievement scores. We have these falling reading scores. We have all of these really scary doom and gloom reports about us being super behind, you know, in reading as a nation. And I think that kind of forced people to take a step back and consider, what do we do?
Yeah.
And, you know, as it turns out, there was this amazing document, this amazing body of research that is not actually particularly new in terms of a lot of the findings and the research that's being cited in it. And it's also fairly neutral in terms of, it was just looking at how do we acquire written language and what are the best practices surrounding it. So I think it makes sense that, you know, as a nation, as a society, we realized, hey, something's not working. We can't just try the same thing over and over again. Let's look at what has been scientifically proven, what the research actually shows us are best practices for reading, and let's start actually enacting some of those.
Yeah.
And as a result, yeah, we end up with this legislation in so many states. Like last I looked, it was well over 30 have some form of legislation about using scientifically proven instructional practices. And I think no matter what side of, you know, reading instruction you're on, I see it as a benefit, right? I mean, we previously had a lot of different reading practices that had a lot of incidental learning, I guess we would call it, right? They made some assumptions about how kids interacted with text and how kids interacted with literature and the access they had to text and literature. Mm-hmm. And in an ideal world, they're all amazing assumptions, right? This assumption that learning feels good for everybody. This assumption that everybody is going to enjoy learning and enjoy reading. So they're going to do it. So they're going to have access to it at home and they're going to be immersed in it, you know, the entire childhood. Well, it's not true. We know that's not true. And it turns out we need to make sure we're accounting for everybody.
So I want to probe on that just a little bit more because I do find it really interesting the way that you're describing it. So going back to pre-COVID, what I hear you saying is that there were people that were trying to teach reading instruction, but it was, is inconsistent the right word, or
just
not evidence-based? I mean, there are a lot of effort that's not going very far.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, make no mistake, there were issues with teaching and learning before COVID, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're always changing our pedagogy and our theory and our instruction and what we're doing, which is a good thing because the more we learn, like, we should change. That's what rational people do. When you're given information or strategies that are more effective, it's only natural to want to accept them, you know, not just in teaching reading. But yeah, before COVID, I think there were a lot of inconsistencies in the way we were approaching teaching to read, and just teaching in general. I think we had a lot of programs that hoped kids would kind of learn by osmosis, right? This idea of if kids are given patterned texts, they will eventually memorize the words, which that is kind of the goal. I mean, when you're reading a book, how often do you stop and sound things out? Not particularly right. often. Your bank of sight words is humongous, but they weren't always sight words, right? You have to have strategies in order to read them if you've never encountered them before. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that's amazing about really the essence of the science of reading is this idea that we need to stop and give kids the opportunity to practice skills in isolation before we ask them to apply multiple skills at the same time, right? A lot of what we see, you know, in the current landscape is a huge emphasis on phonics instruction, which I will always be behind. That was what I was taught to do mm-hmm. when I was getting my master's in 2010 and 2011. That was kind of the program and how we taught when I was teaching. But I know that wasn't true for everybody. And I love that we're saying, hey, there needs to be an explicit like sequence. Kids need to be taught things in a sequence that makes the most sense, goes from high utility to low utility, allows kids to form as many words as possible first. And then as they gain mastery over those decoding skills, gain mastery over the ability to actually apply individual letter sounds to seamlessly, you know, sound words out and mm-hmm. pick those words off the page, then we can start asking them to incorporate other things. But the awesome part about science of reading to me is that it's also telling us that's true for like every component of reading instruction, because it's excellent for a kid to be able to pick up a book and read it like a robot. That's awesome. For a kid to have zero issues decoding any word, you know, any of the other elementary teachers that are listening to this, I'm sure they've encountered that kid that slams out 200 words correct per minute with absolutely zero form of, you know, expression or anything like that. That's great. But if I was an adult and the only thing I could do was read quickly and I wasn't able to apply what I was reading, it's kind mm-hmm. of, it's not a particularly useful skill.
Yeah.
So I love that science of reading is also telling us, hey, you also need to give kids the opportunity to build knowledge
right.
explicitly and in isolation. Don't ask them to build knowledge while also applying new phonics skills that are super challenging for them. Don't ask them to try to build knowledge while you're also asking them to apply new comprehension skills or do things like making inferences. Also give them the opportunity to just build knowledge or to just build vocabulary. And just like phonics, as you get better at it, it's a lot easier to start combining different facets together.
So I want to unpack a couple things in that answer that you just provided. So you were talking about sort of a sequence of learning and the process of picking up skills in reading. Am I correct in saying that it sort of has to start with the phonics part of it, because you have to understand how the sight words correspond to how you would say it out loud, and then connecting it to, I guess what I would say is background knowledge. And I think you actually use that word in your article, so that it becomes part of a, you know, schema that's in long-term memory. Is that sort of the process that you're describing that you would say is the way we should think about the instruction of reading?
Yeah. I mean, it starts out right with listening. Like I was saying before, it starts out with phonological and phonemic awareness, right? Mm-hmm. That's the absolute precursor. Kids need to learn how to listen before they can learn how to read, you know, and they need to be able to manipulate those sounds as well. So that's the absolute first thing. And it's something that is almost like a little bit of a fear of mine when it comes to this new emphasis on phonics that we have, is that we're going to jump the shark and we're going to just go straight into like the letter sound correspondence without letting kids build those speaking and listening skills first mm-hmm, that are mm-hmm. super, super important. I mean, in the grand scheme of life, think of how often you're asked to listen and comprehend.
Yeah.
But yeah, phonics is, you know, it's definitely the base of reading. we can't ask kids to have reading comprehension skills if they're not able to read, right? I can't have a kid, I can't give a kid a nonfiction article and ask them to, you know, do main idea detail for me if they're not able to access the text.
Right.
It's kind of like this skill floor that you're building up. That said, what is really important is the way that all of these different fundamentals of reading work together to improve each other, right? So, for example, when it comes to sounding words out, I can have total mastery, you know, of my CVC words, my consonant, vowel, consonant words. I can have total mastery over all short vowels. And maybe the kid is at the point where they've got total mastery of, like, their digraphs or their blends, so they can do those two-letter consonant pairings, whether they make a new sound like TH making the sound, or it's a blend like BL making the bl or the sl sound. If a kid is applying all of those things perfectly and they come to a word that they've never seen before and they sound it out, they have absolutely no way of A, feeling accomplished because they don't even know if that's a real word, or B, knowing if they did it right. Right. And that's where I was talking about, I love that there's this increased emphasis on letting kids build vocabulary in isolation from phonics skills, or build their content area knowledge in isolation from new vocabulary and phonics, because we want to make sure that as kids are picking words off of a page, they're able to understand what they're reading and confirm that they're doing it correctly. You know, it'd be like giving a kindergartner a multiplication question. They could put in whatever number they want. They're going to have absolutely no idea if it's right or wrong. And that's kind of what it's like when it comes to reading instruction, of we need to make sure that kids have the ability to reflect on what they've read and confirm if those phonics skills that they're applying are correct. You did ask about kind of that general flow. And yeah, I mean, the way I see it, in an ideal world, you know, we follow like the I do, we do, you do. That's so common as like a general framework for teaching, where I do some instruction and I model the way that it works. Then we try doing it together as teacher and student. And then you have the opportunity and ability to apply those skills independently in order to really master them, right? Phonics definitely follows that, where I'm going to show you these skills. You're going to have the opportunity to do it independently. And then as kids gain some mastery of that, we want them to be able to apply it in context of like real literature. Because, you know, kind of as I alluded to at the beginning, so much of what we do in school, and sadly what we have to care about when it comes to summative and benchmark tests, as much as it'd be great if we didn't have to. so much of your success in school, even at the elementary level, is entirely dependent on your ability to read.
Yeah. A while back, you mentioned the phrase patterned text. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. So a really common type of text, you know, is this patterned text. Or even to go broader in that, we've got didactic texts and authentic texts. I'm sure this is regional and could be semantic. Where I'm from, we call them didactic and authentic. And a didactic or a pattern text is a type of didactic text where it's made with the express purpose of teaching and accomplishing one skill or one idea, right? It's the idea of, I'm going to take a learning objective first and I'm going to wrap some text around it. So that the purpose of that text is to learn one specific thing. A pattern text would be one where the sentence stem at the beginning of the text is the same on every page, so that a kid can, without even flipping the page, predict what the next three or four words are going to be. Oftentimes, these texts also include pictures that can cue a kid on what a word might say, right? So a pattern text could be something like, the kid sees a frog, and on the page you have a kid and they see a frog, and on the next page it's a kid sees the, and then there's a new animal. So you're giving these kids pattern texts where they're repeating the same text over and over and over again. And then there's also pictures that can cue them in on what the words are. And this was a really, really common type of text for us to use as our like foundational reading practice. The problem with it, as I see it, and you know, as research is telling us, is that kids don't have to read in yeah. order to, you know, quote unquote, accurately read those books. Once the kid hears that first text stem, sees it's the same on the next page, and notices that the last word or two is entirely based on the pictures, they can read those first words without looking, and then see the first letters and go, oh, it starts with an F and I see a frog. So it's frog and not toad. If it was a T, maybe they would think to say toad. And as it turns out, that doesn't do a great job of preparing us to read when you don't have all of those supports.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the texts that you're trying to apply your reading skills to outside of your ELA period, outside of your small group instruction or the independent practice where you're providing these kids these very specific materials, they don't follow specific patterns.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're finding that while kids get really good at reading inside that environment, the skills don't necessarily translate when you ask them to step outside of that very controlled ecosystem.
I have a story, actually, after you answer this question, but what are some examples from your perspective then that would illustrate the other side of that equation, which are the authentic texts?
Yeah, so authentic texts really are, I mean, at their core, just so we're all on the same page, you might call them something different. The audience might call them something different. In the classroom before I would call them trade books, but really they're books that are there to inform and entertain. They're really mm-hmm. what we would consider real world literature. They're just regular stuff, a chapter book, a picture book, a newspaper article. They're not written with the expressed idea of like, I'm going to take this one lesson objective that ties to this very specific standard and wrap my entire purpose around it.
Mm-hmm.
Authentic texts are what we're hoping kids are eventually able to read and comprehend on their own, and in an ideal world, enjoy it. You know, yeah. I mean, that was my ultimate goal as a teacher, was always to like instill a feeling of wonderment and amazement and enjoyment, because that's how you get kids coming back. And that's how you get kids actually getting the appropriate amount of practice. Because spoiler, just practicing in the classroom is not enough. You need to yeah. be immersed in reading, just like you would need to be immersed in language to learn a new one and be fluent in it. Authentic texts are really, really fundamental to teaching. And the classroom is absolutely paramount that teachers expose kids to those authentic texts in addition to whatever program they're using or whatever lesson materials they're using. Because if a kid doesn't have the opportunity in a controlled environment to apply that very discrete and explicit skill in an area that's not controlled, they're not going to be able to apply them when they leave that really awesome, safe yeah. ELA environment, right? Because your story problems in third grade math are not going to be full of phonetically regular words that are following your exact scope and sequence. They're not going to be written in a format where the first sentence is always a topic sentence and you always have supporting details mm-hmm. after. You're going to need to be able to fluently read through those words, have skills to try and sound out the words that you don't know, and have the comprehension and background knowledge to actually understand what are these words asking, right? I mean, something as simple as we know much and many and stuff like that usually is an indication of addition, but if it's how much more or how many more, all of a sudden it's subtraction.
Right.
So there's so much reading comprehension that goes into it. And one way that we can help kids in those areas is by allowing them to actually practice skills in an authentic environment, pick up a chapter book that's really exciting to them and is accessible, pick up a nonfiction article that's really exciting to them and have the opportunity to apply those skills. They're not going to be 100% successful, but they don't need to be.
Yeah. So my story that completely relates to this, I was 20 years younger than my oldest brother. And so he was literally in college when I was, you know, getting into kindergarten and first grade, et cetera. And he started passing books down to me when I was in elementary school. It started with, and I don't remember how old I was, but it would have been, you know, first, second, third grade for sure. He gave me peanut books, you know, the peanuts. And and I would devour those. And I eventually went through all of his Peanuts books, and he then gave me Robert Heinlein, who is a science fiction writer. I don't know if you remember that name at all, but Starship Troopers is a movie that you might remember, and it was based on one of his books. And so I started reading those way over my skill level, but because of the topic material being, I think, you know, interesting to me at the time, I devoured them. And And I think the point you're making, that you're not going to be successful, but you still, you have to work your way through complex sentences, complex paragraphs, words that are not yet part of your vocabulary, and then put that in the context of science fiction, you know, where it's fantasy. I mean, that I think that really helped me develop, because I was dyslexic when I was in kindergarten, and I think eventually kind of grew out of that. But I think that going through that challenge of reading authentic texts that my brother was handing down to me was seminal to me becoming a better reader by the time I got into late elementary school, and then certainly middle and high school.
Yeah. And I mean, even just in that story, like there are so, you outlined so many different benefits of authentic texts, and is kind of similar to me. I was a hardcore struggling reader when I was in elementary school. You know, and I'm super open to share about all of my struggles, and I always did with any of my students and any of the parents, because I mean, why not? You know, you gotta make connections.
Oh yeah.
You know, I didn't find out until like I was in my mid-20s when my parents told me that my second grade teacher, Mrs. Agolotti, tried to retain me in second grade because they didn't think that I had the reading skills for it. Huh. And what it came down to was, it's not so much that I couldn't, it was that I didn't like any of the things that they were prescribing.
Yeah.
And because there was no agency over it, I didn't feel motivated enough to actually try on my own. And actually, what ended up making me fall in love with reading, sort of similar to you, was Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah.
I crushed Calvin and Hobbes, like all of it. I didn't always understand it. And I like, now I'm reading through it as an adult. I really didn't understand it when I was a kid. there's some pretty high level thoughts in there, but that act of reading is what got me to enjoy it. And it wasn't until I enjoyed it that I started practicing it on my own and at home. And it wasn't until that time that I was getting the adequate amount of actual reading to really become a good reader. I mean, what's that thing, the 10,000 hours to master, right? I mean, you can, even if you want to take that, oh yeah, it takes 10,000 hours to learn how to play acoustic guitar. Well, it took 10,000 hours to learn how to read, and we're expecting kids to do it by the time they're 8, you know, to be like genuinely fluent by the time they're 8. And realistically, we're expecting kids to be able to read actual books by the end of kindergarten. I think the general population that doesn't serve in an elementary school would be blown away at what the end of year kindergarten expectations are. It's enormous, right? I think most people think of kindergarten and it's like nap time and arts and crafts, and no, kids are doing like running records and have to have reading comprehension skills and have response to literature where they need to answer a question and then go back into the text and find evidence to back up what they answered. Like, wow. These are really high level things for a 5-year-old. And if someone doesn't get to have agency over what they're picking, they're not really going to enjoy doing it. I know, like my ethos, what I really prided myself on when I was teaching, you know, were the connections that I made with the kids. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of coworkers that were significantly more creative than me. You know, you enter their classroom and it was like someone needs to come in from a magazine and take pictures of it because it's just beautiful and immaculate. I had teachers that were significantly more organized than me, right? And more patient. There was everyone I could have pointed to someone, you know, that was better than me at pretty much anything. But what I prided myself on was the connections with kids, and that I always tried to make it fun. as like a generic word. Just, I wanted to create some sense of wonderment and engagement. In my mind, my personal theory was that 20 minutes of a kid having a good time while learning was worth more than an hour of a kid like locked into his desk and not enjoying it.
Yeah.
So that was how I ran my classroom. And I think we kind of have to look at reading instruction the same way. Yes, there has to be like the explicit instruction, and you can only make A, apple, ah, so exciting. You can only make learning R controlled vowels so exciting. But you can give kids agency over what they do once they have those skills, right? Let kids dive into a series of articles about dinosaurs. If they're going to read them and be engaged in reading them, they're going to get so much more out of that, not just in terms of practicing those phonics skills, but they're going to learn new vocabulary. They're going to learn new content knowledge. And like, vocabulary and content knowledge is how we build comprehension skills. The more a kid knows about a topic, the more they're going to be able to comprehend it when they're reading within that discipline. And it just, there's so many reasons to infuse your day with authentic literature, to infuse your day with chapter books and graphic novels and, you know, just engaging nonfiction. The benefits are almost endless.
So one of the things that I've been pondering while you've been answering that question. So in my field in communication, I'm sort of on the other side of language arts, which is the production, you know, verbal production of thoughts. Based upon your experience with, especially with young children, is there a correlation? I don't know how to ask this question in a way that makes sense. Is there a correlation where the reading skills produces verbal skills that then become self-reinforcing with the reading skills to sort of, you know, accelerate skill development? Does that question make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it absolutely, like, reading comprehension and your ability to decode is hugely impacts your expressive language, your ability to speak and your ability to write. The more we read, the better, the more eloquent we are, the more tactful we are, the more, the easier it is for us to actually put ideas into sensible and logical thoughts. I think if we were to poll all of the teachers in America, I bet almost all of them, or a statistically substantial amount of them, would say one of their favorite free time activities is reading, right? Because the more you enjoy reading, the better you are at communicating verbally. And teaching is really all about being able to communicate in a clear and concise manner, and help people make connections. But yeah, I would say being able to help reading is an excellent way to help speaking and listening. But the other side is also super true. Speaking and listening is an excellent way to help students with reading comprehension.
Yeah.
And it's a skill that's really difficult. You know, back when I was teaching and was looking at some of the benchmark and summative assessment information, a lot of the strands that you saw students struggling in was nonfiction texts and nonfiction comprehension. And weirdly, speaking and listening was, like, the listening comprehension section was almost always lower than the reading comprehension section, which I found absolutely wild, because in my mind, kids all know how to listen, or at least it, for the most part, like, there's no skill floor to the listening component for the most part. But if a kid had to read a text that was too high level for them, there's no way they could comprehend it. But it turns out it's a totally different skill for students. And nonfiction as well. Nonfiction is so hard.
Yeah. It's interesting. My dissertation looked at the impact of note taking on learning, and the reason it's relevant to what you just said is that there's a lot of interesting literature about college students when they're in a lecture listening situation, about how they use different parts of their brain to process information than if they were reading that same information. So the difference between reading prose and then listening to that same content orally is huge. And that, you know, there are different skill sets that are involved in processing what you hear than what you read. I think that's really interesting based upon what you just said for younger kids.
Yeah. And like, to me, the secret of education has always been that, you know, the lower level you go, the more expert they are in the actual teaching component. Not so much the content component, but, you know, to me, no one will ever convince me that kindergarten teachers aren't the most skilled practitioners of education.
Because
what it takes at that level is insane. And one of the things that you learn is that kindergarten teachers are exposing kids to so many different modalities of learning, right? They're speaking so that kids have to listen. There's the reading component. There's the visual component. You give them kinesthetic learning opportunities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being able to engage kids on all of those different levels and in all of those different skill sets is such a great way to help out. You know, that's why I love audiobooks. I love audiobooks for kids, and I love audiobooks for me. Mm-hmm. You know, that was honestly why I used Pebble Go in my classroom, and how I ended up finding Capstone was like, I loved the read aloud component, even for kids that, you know, they don't need it.
Yeah.
Right. Like they can totally access this text, this article on, you know, dinosaurs was absolutely no problem. Or the article on Cristiano Ronaldo, absolutely. They knew all those words. They could read it totally flawlessly. But being able to read it and then also being able to listen to it, they built the knowledge better. And the more knowledge that they built, the easier it was for them to step into a new article or a piece of information that is maybe a higher text load or a higher rigor, because the more knowledge they had, the easier it was for them to be able to kind of self-regulate and think, does this make sense? Like this word that I just read, does it make sense? Oh yeah, it does. So I love being able to engage kids on all of those levels. I wish there wasn't such a huge stigma around like audiobooks versus reading, because knowledge building is such an integral part to building a skilled reader.
Yeah. So I guess the last line of questions that I want to talk about is sort of the approach that Capstone takes to try to implement, you know, everything that we've just been talking about. But you've mentioned Pebble Go. I also know that Capstone is very involved in creating classroom libraries. Mm-hmm. In general, you know, how would you say that the philosophy of teaching reading that we've been talking about gets enacted through, you know, the multiple product lines that Capstone makes available for teachers and schools?
Yeah. So the biggest thing for me, like absolute biggest, we both talked about it, is the idea that kids really need to be immersed in reading. It, like just reading during the day, just reading during your ELA period is not enough for most of your students to become skilled readers. And I think it's just human nature that we're not going to do things we don't like, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to spare time, and doubly so for kids who are not naturally intrinsically motivated to do things, right? That as an adult, I can feel confident that if I read a text about a skill that I'm trying to learn, it'll feel good when I'm able to do that skill. Kids don't have that foresight yet. So the first thing that I really love about the products, about the books that we make, and about any of the content that we have, is that we're not beholden to a scope and sequence. We're not beholden to some specific, you know, learning outcome. And as a result, we get to just make stuff that kids enjoy reading. Mm-hmm. The motto is like making learning fun since 91 or all of that. But one of the things that really stuck with me was we make content that teachers don't have to use. We make content that teachers and kids want to use. Mm-hmm. And that's so huge, because if you can get a kid to pick up a book at home instead of their PlayStation controller, you're winning the battle, right? If you're in the car on the way to your grandparents' house, and instead of them logging into Roblox on their iPad, they pull up an ebook and listen, you're winning the battle. And that's something that I am very proud of when it comes to being part of Capstone. Mm-hmm. Every book is just so thoughtfully curated in terms of making sure that it's something a student will enjoy reading. And helping teachers win that battle is, to me, the biggest value that we have. In terms of like some art digital stuff, which, you know, when it comes to using technology in the classroom, I was in the classroom right at the advent of smart boards becoming a really popular thing. That was like, you know, kind of the early 2010s. Mm-hmm. There was always this motto from every company that came to pitch us, and there was a motto in every CU, there was a motto in every PD, and it was that technology is here to augment, not replace, right? It's the idea of if a kid's on a Chromebook or if a kid's using a smart board, you're not replacing what you're doing. You're just making what you were doing, hopefully, better. And that's something that is really, really well thought out when it comes to ebooks and Pebble Go. I talked about the importance of listening. I loved that Capstone is really committed to every single book is read aloud by a professional voice actor. There's no text-to-speech. It's all real people reading in a real fluent voice, so you can actually use it as a model. Mm-hmm. You know, that regardless of the reading wars that are happening, or, you know, who is the current antagonist of reading instruction, it doesn't matter. You go back to the 50s, there's been like one fundamental truth when it comes to reading, maybe two. One, kids need to read. You need to. But two, hearing a fluent reader helps build fluency. And that's something that is really, really well done at Capstone, is making sure mm-hmm. that every book, every single one, is done by a professional voice actor in a studio. And it's amazing because that also allows kids to build knowledge even if they can't access the text. Mm-hmm. Something that, you know, is really difficult as a teacher was if I wanted to do a project, even something super simple, just like a super simple poster project in science, you know, just want kids to read about a topic and then show me what they learned about a topic. If they were reading below grade level, it was so hard to find them content that they could access. And almost every single time, the content that I did find was super watered down.
Yeah.
And giving teachers like that really easy scaffold, allowing them to say, hey, you're not going to get a watered down, you know, nonfiction article. You're not going to get a watered down chapter book. You're going to access and you're going to be able to read and follow along and learn at grade level text is huge, because now they're building grade level knowledge while we're trying to catch them up to grade level reading instead of letting them fall behind in both areas.
Yeah.
And that's just like so huge, and it saves so much time. Oh my goodness. Kids are super creative. The project part was always the easiest part, because if I couldn't figure out exactly what I wanted them to do, they'd come up with ideas of how they could share their knowledge. That was not a problem. But
yeah,
finding things for them to learn from, that was so difficult.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Joe, it's been great talking with you, and I really appreciate the stories that you've told. It's been really fascinating to learn your perspective on reading. I think that it provides great information for teachers and parents alike, and you give a lot of great suggestions.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. This is really exciting.
Absolutely. My guest today has been Joe Burns. He's a former classroom teacher and currently a regional product manager for Capstone, an educational technology and publishing company. If you want to learn more about Joe's perspective in the text accompanying the podcast, we have a link not only to his bio, but also to the article in eSchool News that I referenced a couple times during our interview. Thank you for listening to Teaching Matters. Our audio engineer and associate producer is Adam Rich. Our assistant producers are April Koska and Trinity Sweet. I'm your host, Scott Titsworth. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.